We're coming to the next witness. We'd like to call Mr. Peter Hansen. He will deal with the topic United Nations involvement in Palestine from the mandate to the present.
Thank you very much. It's a very large topic I've been given, and I would like to start out by saying that we are not always making very clear what we mean when we talk about the United Nations. We often refer to it as if it is a distinct subject, unitary actor that can have motives and that can be blamed for what it does or what it doesn't do. But the UN is many things. As we have seen in New York here in the last week, it is very much a stage in which the politics are being played out, as it were, where other actors use this stage to interact in formulating their policies and deciding on whatever action they want to do individually or collectively. But the UN can also be an actor itself in certain instincts, and we do have to distinguish a bit between what we mean by the UN. I will just emphasize here that it is a conglomerate of fora, of networks, and administrative structures, of governments, increasingly NGOs, experts, civil society, etc. Where each pursue their own interests, and as such, it becomes a bit difficult to share blame and praise for the UN when we are dealing with such a completely amorphous subject as we are. Of course, it's not all fragmentation and confusion. There is a unifying tend in the UN, namely, it has its charter, which forms a basic framework for all of these activities, from which a fragmented system can draw its legitimacy. The charter sets out purposes, aspirations, principles of peace, justice, human rights, development, which we have sometimes seen actively pursued and sometimes more observed in the breach. Instead of going through the history, and I'm not going to take you from the mandate to today, I would rather make a point of some six functions that the UN is performing in relation to the to Palestine, in relation to Palestine. But before taking them up, just to mention the mandate that I shall not spend time on, I think it's worthwhile mentioning that the concept of justice as being something that always flows from international universal organizations like the League or the UN is not necessarily something one should take without a very large grain of salt. In the mandate for Palestine, unlike all the other mandates, the cards were stacked against Palestine by having the Balfour Declaration written into it. So whereas other mandate areas of the League could go on fairly simply, not very simply, but they could go forward and have states formed, which was not really the case for Palestine, that already in the mandate had written into it, by the way, you have to make space for the Jews as a homeland. And that is one case in which the cards were stacked against Palestine from the very beginning. And when we look at the UN involvement in Palestine over it, the cards were stacked too. Ilan made reference to the resolution 181 and the distribution of land and population at the time. It was not a very fair deal that the Palestinians were offered. A great majority in their land were giving the smaller part of their territory and the smaller group was given the larger part of the land. So one does have to bear that in mind when one concentrates. But the functions I would like to just mention is first the six functions. The first one is the United Nations as a source and generator of international norms and international law. Secondly, it has the function, to some extent, and I'll get into this, of implementing and seeing these norms realized and, if necessary, enforce them. A third function is adjudication in interpreting the norms and deciding to what degree they are or not maintained and to what degree they should be. The fourth is a function of tracking what is going on in these areas, supervision and monitoring. The fifth one that I have been particularly engaged in as Commissioner General for UNRWA for 9 years is the operation of humanitarian activities. And finally, you have a vast array of activities concerned with development and institution building in Palestine. First of all, with regard to the normative functions, the General Assembly and its various subsidiary bodies have generated a vast body of international law, and let us single out and keep in the center the Human Rights Declaration, the Human Rights Covenants, the Convention on the Child, and various others. And we have the very important body of international humanitarian law that is not generated by the General Assembly, but the ICRC in Geneva. These complexes of laws and norms set essential standards for the accountability of action by member states and should set such standards for accountability in the occupied territories. After a first, if you will, normative activism with the resolution 181, the partition resolution, and I should mention also resolution 194 about the right of return. I think of this resolution as the birthright of Palestinian refugees. I have not been able to find a Palestinian child in a refugee camp who could not quote more of resolution 194 and the rights that endowed them than a Danish child could quote from the Danish institution or an American child could quote from theirs. That norm and that expression it has been given through the UN is something that is very, very defining for the identity and perception of the rights of Palestinians. At the same time, it's a norm and it's a principle that you don't bring up in polite discourse in Israel, and that you don't bring up in polite discourse anymore, even in the United Nations resolutions and negotiations. You can refer to relevant resolutions and so on and imply resolution 194, but you don't even mention it anymore. It has gone so far out of use, almost as being seen as being illegitimate to quote as a basic right of the Palestinians. For a long time, there was a complete lull then in UN engagement with the issue. Palestinian issue in the UN was basically reduced to a question of humanitarian issues. What do we do with the poor people? How do we feed them and give them tents and what have you for basic survival? And it took a war, namely the 1967 war, to bring the Palestinian issue back in any meaningful form in the UN. And here we again see a UN norm or UN decision being this time formulated and stated by the Security Council, namely a resolution 242 with its Land for Peace edict setting the framework for all discussions about peace in the area. We have had Palestine now as a fixed agenda item for many years since resolution 32-36 in 94 that established the right to self-determination, national independence, and sovereignty. And we've had an annual reconfirmation of this, of these Palestinian rights. One might dismiss this as so much more paper going through the UN mill, but if we didn't have it, the Palestinian question might run the risk of the destiny it had from the founding of Israel until the 67 war of being basically forgotten. Now, the activity in the UN on this takes part as a number of large number of UN resolutions on Palestine every General Assembly. And it takes place in a series of meetings in the Security Council. So whereas the normative function works, the functions that should help implement these norms have been completely stalemated in the Security Council, and we all know that it has been the United States that has provided a great many vetoes to ensure that complete stalemating. I am not so sure sometimes that this is not sometimes convenient to the Europeans, that they can hide behind the United States and not come out and be counted when they are called upon, because the United States will do the blocking that is necessary in the Council. Then we come to the third, the second function I mentioned, namely realizing these norms, translating them into agreements and into reality, negotiation, in other words. The UN was again very active in the early years with Bernadotte, who was murdered, as we all know, and Ralph Bunche, who succeeded in the armistice negotiations. But again, it very quickly became peripheral to the issue until really the Madrid Conference in 91. This is again something that Ilan pointed to, Israel not accepting anybody but themselves to decide what the issues are and how they should be resolved. They can sometimes accept the United States, but other third parties or mediators are not really welcome. Madrid, and after that in Oslo, then the peace process started, and many of us, I'm sure, even many were critical from the very beginning, were hopeful that this would lead to something, that we have seen a process of bargaining that would lead to some form of justice. I would take issue with that without having time to go into the substantive details of it, but I would like to emphasize that this has not been a process that has been guided by the first function of the UN, namely setting norms, standards, and values. This has very much been a matter of bargaining, horse trading, and making deals without very much attention to whether there was any realization of the justices, the principles, and the values that were expressed in the charter or in the various resolutions. I don't think I'm speaking unduly negatively when I say that it has this process that is now more and more written in inverted commas, of course, and that's justified, has degenerated into an exercise in futility. and to the people watching this process for the, what is it, 22nd year or something like that, for these people and for the people in Palestine, has become a cruel joke. And I can think of it only as a cruel joke every time I hear politicians in Europe and in the United States making great references to the process and trying to give people hope that this process is going to lead anywhere at all. There is always a tension, a built-in tension, between my function number one and the function number two. One is to be creating and guarding norms and values and principles. Another one is when you negotiate. How much do you let your negotiation be guided by these norms and values? How much can you compromise on norms and values and still have an acceptable tension between the two? I think a problem we are facing in the United Nations, and I would like to make that point with the example of the United Nations participation in the so-called quartet. Now, in the quartet, consisting of the US, of the European Union, of Russia, and the UN, as you probably all know, we have power brought together with legitimacy. At least that's how it was sold in the first instance. The UN brings the legitimacy to the table, and the US brings power. The Europeans bring money, and God knows what the Russians are bringing. But in this process, the test of that, I would think, is to look for evidence. Where did the UN affect an outcome that would make these negotiations more value-driven, more principle-driven, more even-handed? Look at that with a very large magnifying glass and every statement of the quartet, and I think you will come up disappointed. If you look at where US interests have been reflected very strongly, it has certainly not been in imposing or in insisting on principles and international law. It has been every time, again and again, to favor an Israeli position. And one sometimes, when one looks at these things, imagine that the US would go to quartet meetings with Israeli instructions on what the outcome should be. That certainly is not any balance. And it's difficult to talk balances between power and principles. You cannot be purely one or purely the other, but you have to be within certain bounds of respecting and being guided by principles in such a negotiation process. Now, much has been said about the quartet, but I'm afraid that even as good as the intentions might have been in them from the start, the image of the UN for impartiality, for concern and seriousness about its own norms, I think have suffered very much from this participation. And one thing in the road forward is that whatever roadmaps and other things that the quartet has come up with, that is hardly the way forward if one wants to see the UN play a role as a framer with the values and the principles. Judicial, and I shall be faster with the last functions, here the International Court of Justice has been relatively little used, but there is the very important advisory opinion from 2004, which is a major contribution in bringing principles of international law to bear upon the treatment of the question of Palestine anywhere. There is now a comprehensive principle statement that makes clear the illegality of settlements, of the duty to observe human rights and humanitarian law in the territories, and of course the question of the applicability of the Geneva, the fourth Geneva Convention, especially. Supervision and monitoring sounds bureaucratic and so on. But I want to mention it because if it weren't for organizations like the Human Rights Council, the much maligned one, we've had in through that an institution of special rapporteurs on human rights. And one of the most illustrious, one of them is sitting on the table here, and I can recommend warmly to all of you to read as many of these reports as possible. I don't think there's a better compendium of the human rights situation in the territories than in the series of reports we have from the special rapporteurs on human rights. And then the collection, analysis, and dissemination of data. If we can paint a picture, that should be compelling, of the misery and the suffering of the Palestinians. That is very much because it is as well documented as it is by United Nations bodies in the area. And that's maybe to some a trivial function, but I think a very important one to keeping the eyes fixed on what is going on with an objective lens. And again, without being overly bureaucratic, there is an Office of Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, which I was very doubtful about in the beginning when it was established, but I have had reason to correct myself. Their analysis and checking the checkpoints and documenting the lack of mobility in the territories is a sine qua non to understand why there is such a terribly serious situation economically, socially, etc. Humanitarian, and again, that's a function, humanitarian operations, to which I have been particularly attached. UNRWA, the largest UN agency anywhere, 30,000 staff, some almost 5 million Palestinians are registered with UNRWA. You cannot go anywhere in the world and see a larger UN presence than you do in the occupied territories. In Gaza, it is very, very strong. You can barely drive a kilometer without seeing an UNRWA school or an UNRWA clinic or anything. And no doubt, UNRWA has a lot of contributions that they have made in education, in health, in social affairs, again. But significant as these achievements are, shouldn't we stop and ask that, should we only be dealing with the symptoms? Should we only be treating a cancer with a Band-Aid? Is humanitarian action not a substitute for what the UN has never been able to deliver, namely political solutions? And the UN, I'm afraid, comes up very short on that. My experience as head of this organization for these many years was that I was not supposed to talk about anything except how to get the trucks to the delivery places or get the school programs organized from year to year. Questions about the reasons behind the need for humanitarian assistance was not welcome, really, to be commented upon from my side or from the agency side in the larger donor community. They like to think that they have bought redemption. They, after all, give some money every year, so what else do you want us to do? And then UNRWA becomes a very, very bad excuse and a cover for non-action and an excuse for political passivity. Development, I shall not take the time to go into this whole issue of engagement and involvement of the UN organizations in this, but I would like to make the point that whatever the UN is delivering, food, education, and so on, all good and fine for the Palestinians. But what they really care about when they see UNRWA and when they deal with UNRWA and the other ones is that is a sign that there is international commitment. How insufficient and short in desirability it may be, it was more important, I felt, when I dealt with refugees, that I showed them respect, I showed them we cared, and we were not there only to feed the hungry. We were there to show that we were there with them, and that at least there were some in the international community who could show some solidarity with their fate and their suffering. Now, let me finish by saying I've very briefly run over these functions, and of course they're much more complex and so on than I've been able to do in a short time. But the first one I started out with, namely the normative one, is to me by far the most important. That is the one where the UN has been weakest and where there is a great deal of risk that the UN will not stand up to and not follow and not pursue as a guiding its own norms. Where the UN has been strongest in operations in the field, it's important, it's good, and you know, people are not starving and suffering quite as much as they would if we would have left it to Israel to fulfill its obligations as an occupying power under the Fourth Convention, which I have no idea at all that they would have taken very seriously, certainly not from what I've seen. But we need to find a better balance between these different functions of what the UN does and what the UN doesn't do, what the UN does well and what the UN does less well. We cannot generalize and we cannot give an assessment of good, bad, or indifferent, because as I started out saying, the UN is a very complex set of institutions, and you cannot just simplify and oversimplify and call them by one assessment or the other. So I'm pleading for the UN to be a bit more balanced in activating, however that is done, its normative principled functions. Not participating anymore in the quartet would just be a little negative step to it, and maintaining, as much as there is no other alternative, its assistance to the Palestinian people. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Peter Hansen. Just to quickly remark on your very strong language, the reference to the whole UN process vis-a-vis the Palestinians as having become a cruel joke. The fact that the United States plays this particular role, the fact that endless number of the resolutions are not implemented, that Israel is allowed to get away with impunity vis-a-vis the violations of Palestinian rights. The UN is losing credibility, and no peace-loving person, no rational person wants to see the UN in demise. We want to see the UN playing its role as it has in the past, as it did on Palestine and South Africa through the 70s, particularly when resolutions were passed on racism in relation to Israel practices. So everybody has the question, how to put teeth into the UN. Reform of the system is needed, an end to the blocking veto which the US plays and other countries have played, etc. Otherwise it's the cruel joke. Mm-hmm. So your view on that, are we going to sit as a world population waiting for decade after decade, and we'll see the demise of this once august body? Or is it possible, and given the number of countries at the UN, we see it in the General Assembly and the way they vote, to be frustrated at the Security Council? What can be done? That is the key question. Is it possible?
I think one thing that cannot be done is to reform the United Nations from within and change the mandates and change this and that in the way resolutions are adopted. Change can only come about by pressure upon the governments who call the shots in the United Nations. And that means having events like this won't do it all, but mobilizing public opinion to start asking questions of the governments. Why are we not recognizing Palestine? Why can't we not accept Palestinian membership of the United Nations? And have these sorts of activist questions raised effectively. That means so much more than moving around the boxes on a organigram and so on that is going to get us absolutely nowhere, I'm sure. This is no easy prescription. It's very long, it's very tough, but I think you have seen significant change in the way in which the issue is perceived in public opinion in the Western world. It's a long haul, but if you take a 15-year perspective, you will see significant change has taken place. I don't want the Palestinians to wait for another 15 years until some of these resolutions are implemented, but certainly working along these lines would be a lot more promising than discussing how you could give teeth to resolutions and so on.
Thanks very much for such a clear-cut reply. And I'm sure that activists in the world would really welcome your encouragement. Two quick questions, one from John Dugard, and then I recognize Mike Mansfield as well. But keep it quick, and the answer as well, so that you can move on. Thank you. John, you've got the floor.
It's on.
First of all, I would just like to say that while I was special rapporteur in the occupied Palestinian territory, there was one UN institution that was very credible and very popular, and that was UNRWA under the leadership of Peter Hansen. It was the most popular institution in the Palestinian territory, more popular than the Palestinian Authority itself. But my question relates to the quartet, which you have mentioned, because it seems that the United Nations has handed over the peace process entirely to the quartet. But the strange thing is that the quartet refuses to speak to Hamas, and the United Nations refuses to allow its special envoys and leaders to speak to Hamas. Two questions. Who is responsible for the decision not to speak to Hamas? And secondly, do you believe that peace can be achieved in the region without some overtures towards Hamas and without the United Nations, through its representatives, speaking to Hamas itself?
Thank you very much, John. I can be very brief on the first one because I really don't know. I have read Alvaro de Soto's internal paper. Kofi Annan's memoirs are just out these days, and I don't think any of them provide the clear answer. To my view, the UN was too overeager to have a seat at the table no matter what. And that became the important thing. So we'll forget about the... That's unfair to say that. I don't think anybody in responsible situation in the UN ever said that. But certainly give less weight and priority to the normative side, to international law. On the second question...
Can a meaningful peace be achieved without... talking to Hamas?
No, of course it can't. Where has peace ever been achieved where a very significant actor in the system is put outside? I mean, once upon a time, PLO could not be spoken to. Now they are monopolizing relations, or trying to anyway. Take every negotiation in Central America, in Mozambique, Angola, and so on. Only when you let in and you talk to all the parties is there any prospect of the exercise being meaningful, and it is absolutely not meaningful to go on with this, excluding even communication with one significant party that cannot be ignored. Further ignoring it will only increase hostility towards the UN and increase the popularity of Hamas in the context as those who are standing upright.
Thank you. A quick one from you, Mark.
Yes, it'll be quick. Can you hear? Is it all right? The microphone.
Yes.
You mentioned the advisory opinion of the ICJ, the International Court of Justice in The Hague, which is an apocryphal and classic watershed in this, and sets out the principles very clearly. I'm just going to read one paragraph. It's 160 in the judgment. Finally, the court is of the view that the United Nations, and especially the General Assembly and the Security Council, should consider what further action is required to bring to an end the illegal situation resulting from the construction of the wall and the associated regime. We all know they've done nothing. Now, this was an opinion that the UN requested from the ICJ. They give their opinion, they hand it back and say, you get on with this, and they don't. Now, it seems to me, in a nutshell, unless the United Nations itself is prepared to reform its procedures and abolish the veto for the five permanent members and extend the Security Council's membership and democratize it, we're going to get nowhere, because public opinion will be vetoed by the US every single time.
I can't agree more, but doing away with the veto is not going to be simple as long as each veto holder has a veto against it. So, sorry about that.
Thank you. Okay. There actually is a silent way of clapping. But Angela, quick question from you.
Yes, just a very brief question. I appreciated your description of the frustrations you experienced in your role as the under commissioner of the Undersecretary of Humanitarian Affairs and the Commissioner General of Relief and Works Agency. I appreciated your description of the frustrations you experienced and this tendency to substitute humanitarian action as important as it might be, but to use that as a substitute for political solutions.
Yeah.
And I also appreciated your call to activists around the world to put pressure on our governments to recognize Palestine. Now, I'm wondering how, and I guess this question relates to John's, whether you think there are certain structures within the United Nations that would militate against these transformations, and how would activists most effectively focus their opposition? Mm-hmm. What kinds of structural changes might also be called for?
Thank you. The UN has a division on Palestinian rights, and they're doing their level best to motivate and mobilize public opinion. Small budget, two or three meetings around the world every year. That's not going to do much. Mm-hmm. But I have found, when I've seen the Human Rights Council and the old commission in action in Geneva, there's an extraordinary mobilization of NGOs and activists and so on, and I have no doubt that it has influence. If we could see the same sort of thing, I'm sure we'll never see it outside the meeting chambers of the Security Council. That would be one thing, but I don't think that's a way to go. It has to go through opening up, pressuring on national decision points. National decision points. And there, I think it is quite encouraging that public opinion is changing, and I'm sure will continue to change. And I'm just hopeful it won't take forever before that change will be affecting the situation in the territories.
Only to say that we warmly welcome Mr. Ari Belafonte. You are welcome. You are welcome.
What is it? Thanks. Just a quick word from my co-chair before we call.
It's not a question. C'est une réflexion du latino-américain que je suis. Comme vous savez, parmi les choses évoquées par Peter sur l'évolution du monde, de la planète, toute l'Amérique latine est derrière l'État palestinien. Nous avons tous voté pour. Et beaucoup de pays d'Amérique latine ont demandé le changement urgent du Conseil de sécurité. Entre autres, l'Argentine, qui a été très, très présente dans les dernières réunions aux Nations Unies. La transformation de ce Conseil de sécurité pour éviter qu'il y ait toujours des pays qui font ce qu'ils ont envie de faire et qui ont la possibilité de veto contre une immense majorité qui, dans le cas de la Palestine, soutient un État palestinien. Ce n'est pas une question, c'est une réflexion latino-américaine.